So Far From Home, The Diary of Mary Driscoll, An Irish Mill Girl, by Barry Denenberg, pages 44 through 66. Friday, June 18th, 1847, at sea. The ship is buzzing with excitement. Word is spreading like wildfire. Mr. Corcoran has heard the rumors that we are nearing America. Now he stands on deck all day, one hand holding his ticket, the other the railing. He stares straight ahead, waiting. I don't know where he gets the strength. Sunday, June 20th, 1847, at sea. Sean saw seaweed floating on the surface of the ocean. We are indeed nearing land. Sweet Jesus, it's been so long, I dare not hope. Monday, June 21st, 1847, at sea. At long last, land. Just saying the word, land. I feel like I've been on the ship for all eternity. Lowell, Massachusetts. Tuesday, June 22nd, 1847, Boston Harbor. Glory to be God, 'tis true, America, you can see it. Everyone who could walk rushed up on deck, bringing their bundles and their cases with them. Many fell to their knees and gave thanks to the Lord in heaven. Others wept and embraced those around them as tears ran down their cheeks. 'Tis over, this horrible voyage is over. My new life is about to begin. I give thanks to the Lord who mercifully granted me the good fortune to see this day. Many were not so fortunate. Wednesday, June 23rd, 1847, Boston. So much has happened. I must try to write. When the medical officer and the other men boarded the ship, the celebration ended. Everyone crowded together on deck, thinking the nearness would protect us. The men stretched ropes across the fish so that there was only enough room for one person at a time to walk. They went to calling out names. Those whose names were called walked between the ropes to where the medical officer stood, waiting, and quickly he worked. Those he judged healthy were allowed to leave. Those he thought ill or feverish were stopped and questioned. One wee boy was found to be infected. His mother begged to remain with him, but her pleads were for naught. The boy was too sick to even cry out and was carried away. 'Twas his poor mother they held back, but little enough could they do to hold back her shrieks, which stabbed the air. I tried not to watch, but my eyes were fixed, like a moth to the flame. Saddest of all were the Corcorans. First the medical officer examined the twins and Brendan. 'Tis a miracle the children have never had a day's sickness since the voyage began. Mrs. Corcoran looked drained, but was not feverish. They were allowed to pass. Then came Mr. Corcoran. He was having trouble standing. The medical officer was asking him questions, but no answer was coming. He wasn't even looking at the officer, looking right past him. He was to America. He was still clutching his losing lottery ticket in his hand. Suddenly he was pushed to the side, and before anything could be done, he was led away. I began to move forward to help, but Sean was grabbing my arm. Mrs. Corcoran looked confused. Everything was happening so fast. "Be on your way," one of the men shouted. Mrs. Corcoran carried Sophie while Brendan took Molly by the hand, and they made their way down to the wharf. How will they find each other, I thought. What will happen to Mr. Corcoran? Where was he being taken? Mary Driscoll, the man called out. Go, Sean whispered, be brave. Trembling I was, while the doctor looked in my eyes, he asked me to open my mouth and hold out my tongue. I prayed that I showed no signs of the fever. He was standing close and looking at me. His eyes were coal black and as hard as flint. Afraid to look at him I was, but afraid not to. If I looked away, he would think I have something to hide. Finally, he looked down, wrote something on a piece of paper, put a blue tack on my shawl, and told me to move along. Sean said to wait and not let anyone help me, no matter what. His uncle warned him that the runners will steal from you or try to take you to one of the boarding houses. Then they will demand to be paid for their service. America, he said, is no place for a fool. I waited for Sean while keeping a sharp eye out for Aunt Nora. 'Twas chaos all around me, passengers streaming off the boat, people being greeted by their families and friends. 'Twas a scene of wildest excitement, I promise you that. everyone running after one thing or the other. I didn't see how Aunt Nora would ever find me, but I stayed rooted to the spot just the same. Suddenly a man appeared out of nowhere. He snatched the bundle from my arms and told me he would be pleased to find me proper loadings. "We have no need for your services," someone behind me was saying. "'Twas Sean, and with him his uncle, Mr. Quinn, was not as tall as Sean, but as thick as a stone wall he was. His face wore a terrible look. He told the man we didn't need aid of any kind from the likes of him. Praise God, the man dropped the bundle, turned, and disappeared into the crowd. I was still not seeing Aunt Nora. The docks had emptied. Only a few sailors and stragglers were still about. The sky was turning dark. "We must leave soon," Sean was saying. Where was it but to Aunt Nora's... Where was it but to Aunt Nora's that I had to go? Why was she not there to meet me? Only God can say. What would I do? I didn't even know Kate's address. I couldn't leave until Aunt Nora came. "Go on without me," I said. "I will be all right." Sean said he would not be going without me. He would stay all night if waiting was my choice. But he said, "'Tis a foolish thing to do." Sean's uncle said, "'Twas not likely my aunt would be coming at this late hour. Misconnections are common so that so many Irish are coming to America. Sometimes a ship is late or a letter gets lost. He promised to place a notice in the Irish newspaper. All will turn out well in the end, young lady," he assured me. Mr. Quinn urged to allow him to make me to his home for some food and a good night's rest. I was hungry and tired to the bone. I was sorely in need of shelter for the night. "'Tis a long road that has no turning," he said gently. I accepted his kind offer. The roads are not paved with gold, as Aunt Nora said. I asked Sean's uncle if he would be coming upon them soon, and he laughed heartily. There is so much to see and hear. The tall houses with their spires and chimney tops are piled one on top of the other. Everything is bigger than back in Skibbereen. The roads are filled with people rushing around, moving so fast, and all at the same time. Not one slowed to rest. Carts and carriages of every shape and size drive wildly, their warning bells ringing out. No one pays any mind. They barely look before stepping into the road, and the carriages flying past their noses. Everywhere I look, there were Irish. 'Tis a wonder there are so many of us left in Ireland. They seemed as worn and hungry as those I left behind in Skibbereen. Some were begging for food. Some were standing on the street corners. Still others simply stared out from doorways. Far from the kings and queens I expected to see dressed in their robes of red. Friday, June 25th, 1847, Boston. John's uncle was able to find out where Alice O'Donnell was living from a man he knows at his tavern. 'Tis a miracle, if you ask me. We found the building, but there were so many rooms we didn't know where to begin. Finally, a man came out and told Mr. Quinn that Alice O'Donnell was in the cellar. She earned her keep doing the wash for her family with a flock of children that lives upstairs. God help her, the poor child was curled up asleep on a mattress when we found her. 'Twas so damp, the mattress was soaked and her clothes were wet. Not a ray of light and precious little air to breathe down there. When Mr. Quinn woke her, she opened her eyes wide. I could see the fear within. I reached for her, hoping she would take my hand. She made no move. 'Twasn't because of her fear. The poor child could not see. Why Mrs. O'Donnell did not tell me her daughter was blind, only the Lord can say. Her conditions along with the state she was living in grieved me terribly. Mr. Quinn kept his wits about him. Mr. Quinn kept his wits about him. He told Alice O'Donnell we were friends and we had come to help her. He asked if she could speak, but she said not a word. 'Twas plain for all to see she was horribly treated. Mr. Quinn and Sean left to find the family she worked for while I tried to talk to her. Alice O'Donnell remained crouched in the corner, her knees up to her chin, holding herself and rocking. I wanted dearly to find the right words to say. I wanted to tell her I knew her family, that she could trust me, but But wasn't I afraid? How would I ever answer if she asked where they were, when they would be coming for her? Gently I touched her hand, but she pulled back. I tried again, but still she withdrew. I didn't know if I were scaring her more than she already was. 'Twas then I decided to sing, hoping Ma's lullaby might soothe her. On the wings of the wind, over the dark rolling deep, angels are coming to watch over thy sheep. Angels are coming to watch over thee. To watch over thee. So list to the wind coming over the sea. Hear the wind blow, hear the wind blow. Lean your head over, hear the wind blow. Still singing, I tried once more to touch her hands. I could see that some of the fear had fallen from her eyes. This time she let me stroke her fingers and press her hands in mine. She was listening carefully now to every sound. I could tell by the way she cocked her head. Slowly she reached out with her other hand and searched the air for my face. I leaned forward and she found my chin. Then she felt for my mouth and my eyes and she stroked my hair, trying to see how long 'twas. Then we both heard steps, 'twas Sean and his uncle. Alice's hand remained in mine. I don't know what Mr. Quinn said to the family, but when we returned, he was pacing up and down like a caged animal. He said that Alice O'Donnell would be leaving with us. She would stay with him and his wife until it could be decided what was best for her. Then he looked at me. I wasn't sure what he wanted me to do. I told Alice that we were her friends, that I had just come from Ireland. She felt my face again. I told her my name and promised that no harm would come to her. She was tilting her head again. I wish she would talk to me. She moved her hand across my face, feeling the tears falling from my cheeks. My name is Alice, she said in a whisper, and we stood up to leave. Thursday, July 8th, 1847, Lowell. Aunt Nora never received the letter telling her what ship I would be on. 'Twas only she saw the notice in the Pilot, the one placed by Mr. Quinn, that she knew I was in America and sent Kate to get me. As soon as Kate arrived at Mr. Quinn's, she made it plain that she was wanting to leave, so I hurried along as best I could. Aunt Nora was unable to come herself. The journey would be too much for her bad leg. If only I had known 'twas Kate coming in her place, I would have found a way to get to Lowell on my own, to be sure. 'Twas glad I am to see my little sister after all. After all this time, Kate said. But she appeared to be no more glad about it than I. The stagecoach ride to Lowell was a rocky one. The two men who journeyed with us seemed to welcome Kate's chatter. My sister still talks without end, choosing to use two words when one would do. Her favorite subject is still herself. In that way, Kate has changed little in the past 2 years. But she looks and sounds like a different girl. She fixes her hair in a braided crown now, and dresses with great care. She was wearing a fancy white dress. She speaks with a wee sing-song voice that sounds make-believe, like she were a fairy tale princess. Everyone was always fooled by that round, milk-white, innocent-looking face. Even Ma, but not me. My sister has two faces. One she wears on the outside, and one she wears when she thinks no one is looking. I can see she has taken easily to the ways of this new world. 'Tisn't surprising. She went on and on about Mrs. Abbott. Mrs. Abbott and her children are visiting relatives in Philadelphia. Mr. Abbott is the agent for the Merrimack Mills. 'Tis thanks to him I will be working there. Kate said that it was very kind of Mrs. Abbott to allow her to travel all the way to Boston to fetch me, like I were the hen for that night's supper. Proud she is that Mrs. Abbott favors her above the others. Mrs. Abbott considers Kate to be trustworthy, unlike other Irish, my sister said. When she first went to work for Mrs. Abbott, she was cleaning and discovered a dollar under one of the beds. Kate had been warned that this was something Yankee women would do. Mrs. Abbott had placed the dollar there on purpose, just to see if Kate would be tempted. That afternoon, she gave her the dollar, telling Mrs. Abbott that someone must have accidentally dropped it under the bed, and that she hoped Mrs. Abbott would be able to return it to its rightful owner. "Aren't you an angel?" Mrs. Abbott told Kate. Kate lectured me about all the things Mrs. Abbott has taught her, how to set the table, where to place the wine glasses. She has learned how to polish fruit properly and arrange flowers. Kate says Mrs. Abbott likes everything just so. I would think she does. There are times when Mrs. Abbott speaks to Kate like a friend. My sister is quite proud of this. Mrs. Abbott also employs two cooks and a lady from England who looks after the Abbott's children. 'Twas dark when we arrived in Lowell. We went in the back door and up the stairs. Mrs. Abbott does not allow the servants to use the front door and down the hall to Kate's room. Kate said that Aunt Nora picked a fine time to take to bed. 'Tis a great burden for her to take me to the mills in the morning. That much is plain. I don't know what to do. I would go myself, to be sure, but I don't know where they are or how to get there. We are going to see Mr. Fowler. He works for Mr. Abbott as the overseer. I awoke at dawn. The early morning light was just beginning to come through the window. Not even a bird was awake. I was terribly confused. 'Twas like I was in a dream. I wanted to find a place to write because so much has happened. Slowly I left the bed, being sure not to disturb Kate, who was still asleep in bed beside me. I opened the door and went into the hall. I stopped and listened, but heard no sound other than my own breathing. I found myself standing in front of the door that leads to Mrs. Abbott's bedchamber. Mrs. Abbott is away. I remembered Kate saying, no one would be in there. My curiosity was greater than my fear. I went in. The room is big. A wide, white bed that has a white cloth stretched above it is in one corner. It looks like a heavenly carriage. Opposite the bed is a window framed by folds of blue shiny cloth. I parted the cloth and looked down on a beautiful garden closed by a white fence. This, I thought, must be a garden in paradise. Must be what a garden in paradise looks like. This is what I pictured America to be. The walls of the room are covered with paper. Different pleasant scenes are shown. Animals in the forest, flowers in the field, and a picnic by the lake. Along one wall there, the picnic is. Along one wall where the picnic is, I saw the most comfortable-looking ruby-red cushioned chair. I ran my hand over the cloth. 'Twas soft, like the fur of a baby animal. I sat down carefully and put my arms on the arms of the chair. I felt like a queen. I wondered what 'twould be like to live in this house. Across the room is a tall chest of drawers with an oval mirror framed in swirling dark wood on top. I went over to it. Lying on the top was a box made of different woods, some light, some dark. They were put together in a way that made a pattern. 'Twas an A for Abbott. The wood was smoother than any I have ever seen or touched. The box gleamed like still water reflecting the moonlight. What treasures, I wondered, would be in such a precious box. I hesitated, but I could not stop myself. I opened the box, not knowing what to expect. Will you look at that, I thought. Jewelry lying on the rose-colored cloth within were shiny rings, golden bracelets, strings of pearls, and red and green necklaces. Even in the weak light of the coming dawn, the contents of the glorious box shimmered, sparkly and golden. I gently pulled out a long silver necklace with square green stones dangling along its length. I put it around my neck and looked in the mirror. I saw my face for the first time in a long while. My, how thin I look. I touched my cheeks. There is barely any skin on my bones. What if these were my jewels, and 'twas I who was preparing to dress for the evening? Then I heard something. The floorboards above were creaking. Someone was up and about. I closed the box and held my breath. I stood frozen, unable to move. What if someone had heard me, or saw me come into the room? What would they do to me? Why had I come in here? I should have known better. Be still, a voice within me warned. I knew that if I were found, there would be the devil to pay. Perhaps 'twas just someone stirring in the night. Perhaps 'twas my imagination. I heard nothing. Silence. I was afraid to leave the room, but I knew the longer I stayed, the worse 'twould be. The sky was growing lighter with every movement I delayed. I turned the doorknob slowly and pulled the door toward me. Thank the Lord, it made no sound, being careful to close the door behind me. I tiptoed quietly and quickly down the hall and back to the room before anyone saw me. Kate, praise God, was still sleeping soundly. I crouched down by the window to get the light. I am writing quickly, not knowing how long 'twill be before my sister awakes.